best. It doesn't mean I don't have an answer. It just means I can't know for sure all of what's going on here. I do think, as we have said before, keep in mind that we want to recognize that sometimes what's happening is we're in a visionary scene, so sometimes what we're reading is just a kind of a picturized version of what is going on, rather than trying to explain every single detail. Because if you get into trying to explain every little symbol and detail, and what does this head mean, or what does this crown mean, or what does this horn mean? I mean, they do all have meanings, but you have to take them collectively rather than singly, okay, or singularly. And so we talked about last week that the angels are in the midst of pouring out the bowls of wrath, vials of wrath, if you have an older version of the Bible there. And so we see the fifth angel pours out his bowl upon the throne of the beast. Remember, the beast is the imperial power of Rome. That is the position of this particular class. And so if that is true, then what he's doing is he's affecting the very heart of the whole beast empire here. And so he's not just affecting the people of the empire, although that too, but he's actually going after in this targeting of this destruction of Rome and this decree against Rome. He's actually going over the heart of the empire itself, which is the emperors themselves. And it says that the kingdom became darkened, and darkened, of course, has numerous meanings. Here it's not to be taken literal, like the sun literally went out or something like that, but rather darkened in the sense of spiritually ignorant, deprived of truth, deprived of knowledge and enlightenment. That's how darkness is often portrayed spiritually in the Bible, in the New Testament. Have we seen the darkness before in history, biblical history? Like with Egypt, right? One of the plagues against Egypt was the land was in almost a palpable, touchable darkness. I'm not saying it was that, but it was just a thick darkness there. And it says they gnawed their tongues because of pain and blasphemed God because of their pains and sores, and yet did not repent of their deeds. When people get so entrenched in sin, then the only thing they want to do is continue in sin. They don't want to repent. They don't want to change. They don't want to be told that this is wrong. They don't want to stop doing what they're doing, even in the face of adversity and dire consequences. They still want to do what they want to do. Kind of as a parallel to that, you might remember when Lot was approached by the men of Sodom there. Remember this story? And the angel comes and stays with Lot, and then the men of the city want to have relations with him, which is a euphemism for they want to have sex with this man, right? And so the angel blinds the men, and they're still groping, trying to find the door. They're still, despite their blindness, they're still trying to find this angel, because what do they want to do? They want to go have relations with this man, and not even blindness is going to stop them. And I believe that is parable-like for what we're talking about right here, is that even in the midst of God's unleashing of all kinds of trouble and distress and adversity and judgment against the empire, you still have people who are just bent on doing evil, and they're going to do it no matter what, right? I mean, we see this in our own society, that people, they don't want to reform, they don't want to change, they don't want to give up their things, that is. They don't want to find God and find religion and get their head right and their soul right. They don't want any of that. They just want to continue in doing what they're going to do. And they're going to do that at any price. And in fact, even if it takes blaspheming God and in the process, they don't care, because this is what they want to do. It just, again, shows how deeply entrenched this sin is in this people. This is not a situation where the Roman Empire stumbled into a sinful situation over the last several weeks. This has been going on for centuries. It has taken centuries for them to get to this very depraved and decadent state of existence here. The sixth angel, verse 12, pours out his bowl on the great river Euphrates. The water dried up, which obviously did not happen literally, historically, or otherwise. But the Euphrates River does provide a natural boundary for the Roman Empire. That kind of the eastward Roman Empire is a natural boundary there. And so drying up the Euphrates River allows for all those marauding hordes from the east to come into Roman Empire territory. And that's what we do see historically, not that the river literally dried up, but that we start seeing this influx, this invasion, really, of people that want to do nothing more than just plunder the Roman Empire. They don't want to take territory. They don't really take over. They just want to go in there and get their goods and loot and plunder like people do even today when you take away law and police activity. People turn into anarchists. So that's what we saw historically with Rome, and that this is, in my strong opinion, a very picturized version or a picturized explanation of that. And then we have this, as you see in the heading here, Armageddon. He says, I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet. Okay, so we have three in cohort here. Who is the dragon? That's Satan himself. The beast is the emperors, okay, as a system, as the imperial power. And then false prophet would be the pagan religion, in essence, that compels people to worship the emperors as though they were divine beings. So we have all three in unison. And then we have these unclean spirit, like frogs. And they are spirits of demons, John says, performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God, the Almighty. So there's this idea here that that people are conned into thinking that they can fight against God, that they can fight against truth, and I'm speaking of truth with a capital T, in essence, God's revealed truth, that they can fight against God's people. Remember, this is what one of the main premises of the entire book of Revelation is that the churches of Asia are going to be under siege, in essence, by secular forces, that the world is going to, you know, in essence, gang up on them and bully them into submission, and they're going to refuse, and so things are going to get ugly. So the world thinks that it can do this, and we see this gathering here in verse 14, to gather them together. This gathering here is really a uniting together of all these forces, all these different peoples and religions and powers, all to try to stamp out or subdue to the point of irrelevance this church and the religion of Christ and the gospel message and all of that stands for. And they're going to be successful, right? No. Okay? I would hope we get a resounding no at that point. But if you think about it, this is truly a David versus Goliath scenario. You have the church, which is very small proportionally. And you have this huge secular force, which is made up of emperors and armies, and literal armies, and governing authorities, and peoples, masses of peoples. And all those big Goliath-like forces are going to come against the church. And yet the church is going to prevail. In fact, the church is going to outlive all of those other things. The church is going to succeed where all these other things are going to be destroyed. That's really the message that we're seeing here. Now, the church is not going to do that by its own power. And that's why we're reading about what God is doing. God is stepping in and being the power behind their success, behind their victory. Okay? So we are victorious people, but we're not victorious because we're just such great, powerful, self-resourceful people. It's not it at all. It's because we have a God who is stronger than all of our opponents. That's what makes us successful and victorious. Jim.
Verse 14 there.
Yeah, it's kind of an aside, or, you know, kind of a, you know, opening the door to a little bit of what's really going on. Because otherwise, it does sound so bizarre, right? I mean, they've got spirits like frogs coming out of their mouths. What is that all about? But really, it's that demonic activity, that demonic influence, that demonic delusion that is coming upon the people. But there's a source. It's coming out of something, okay? So there is a demonic activity going on in the Roman Empire at this time that's going to be bringing it down, but there's a source of that. And ironically, this part of the source of that is from its own leadership, or a lot of the source of that is from its own leadership and its own false religion. Okay, imagine that, leaders and religious leaders in particular leading people astray. Unheard of, right? It's always happened. Remember, all the trouble trickles down from the top. I mean, if you have good, strong leadership, chances are it's going to trickle down to create good, strong nations and kingdoms. But if you have weak, compromised leadership, well, then that's going to trickle down to a weak and compromised kingdom. It's true with households. It's true with businesses. It's true with churches. It's true with kingdoms or nations, empires. Okay, so this is true across the board. We have bad leadership. It leads to bad things for the future of whoever they're leading. Yeah, Matt. Well, the day of God refers to a judgment day, where a kind of a day of the Lord scenario, where God is bringing judgment on these people. These people think in their minds that they can overthrow God or whatever belongs to God anyway. But God, of course, is going to be victorious over them. But there's going to be a conflict, in essence, is what we're seeing. We're kind of building up to that, building up to a conflict. All right. Now, this is all, if you know anything, and we have talked about this before, if we look at what's going on with premillennialism, they say, well, here's the cross, and then Jesus didn't convince the Jews that he was their Messiah, so they killed him, and so he set up the church in the interim, and then, of course, there's going to be a rapture where all the church in the future, in our future, at some point, is going to be caught up to the sky and leave no church on the earth. And then there's going to be 7 years of tribulation. And 3.5 of those years will be fairly harmless, but the other 3.5, remember our class in numerology? Right? The other 3.5 are going to be a time of great difficulty. So all of it's going to be great difficulty in one way or the other. It's just that it gets intensely worse in the second half. And then at the end of that, there's going to be this great war, this Armageddon. And then after that will be the 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth, in Jerusalem specifically. In fact, depending on which premillennialist you talk to, the temple will be rebuilt in exactly the same place where the temple was built originally by Solomon there in Jerusalem. There's a huge problem with that right now. Does anyone know what the problem is? Mike? What's that? There's a gigantic mosque sitting right on that spot, okay? The Dome of the Rock, I think it's called, right? And so they're going to have to move the mosque, and which means taking on essentially all of Islam in order to do this. Now, the premillennials come back and say, well, you know, Jesus is going to do that by his own strength and power. It says, okay, but now you're creating more questions than you're answering. Because Jesus nowhere says that he's going to come back and reign for 1,000 years on earth. Now, we're going to get to scriptures that seem to talk like that if you have that already preconceived in your mind. But that's not what he says. That's not what it teaches. It says that nowhere. In fact, Jesus says he's done here. In fact, we could make a very strong argument, if we took the time to do so even tonight, we could make a very strong argument that the fact that Jesus sat down at the right hand of God necessarily implies that his work is done here on this earth. If it wasn't, he couldn't have sat down. And I know that sounds weird to hear that if you don't understand the context or the implications of what I'm saying, but the idea there is that he can't sit down and rest from his work. Remember, the rest is part of the work. He can't sit down and reign as king, and therefore rest as his work that led up to that kingship, unless, of course, his kingship is absolutely secured and he's done here. And I would say that to anyone, that Christ is done here. The only time he's going to appear in our physical system whatsoever is to appear in the sky to take us home and to bring horrible things upon this earth to destroy it. But he's not going to stay here. He's not going to be here. My whole point of this here, though, is to talk about this Armageddon right here, that there's going to be this huge cataclysmic battle. And the premillennialists are very big on promoting this huge battle as being a very literal battle somewhere over in Palestine or the Middle East or somewhere over there. And there's going to be this enormous army, and then God's going to come down from heaven and just smote the army or smite the army, I guess, and deliver that devastating blow to it and destroy the entire pagan satanic army and end it all right there, at least for the time being. And that's not what this is saying here. By the way, we should, if we were to take this out further, after the 1,000 years, there's going to be another war, okay, another gathering. This comes out of Revelation 20, verse, I think it's 8 through 11 there, where it talks about another battle, which begs more questions. Where did these people come from to battle against Christ if he's been reigning for the last 1,000 years and taking over the world? There's a lot of unanswered questions. And what it really shows, in my strong opinion, I'll just say it that way, what it really shows is that this whole premillennialist idea is fraught with problems. It's forced, it's contrived, it is plucking things out of thin air that aren't found in Scripture, and just making stuff up in some cases in order to make it work. Anytime you have a doctrine like that, you should have a red flag go up. In this case, many of them that go, you know what, this isn't believable. We should just jettison that whole thing. And indeed, we should. Okay? Will? Right. Right. And the reason they say that is because they have to come up with an army to fight. So it's like, okay, let's back up then. Where do these people come from? They must have fallen away. And it's like, this is making stuff up, right? A lot of people, they go to the MSU, right? Making stuff up. University. And so they literally just plug holes. They've got this big hole, and they're like, well, we got to make something up here. All right, we're going to see more as we go along that there's more of that going on there. So we have this idea here, at least in the modern mindset, toward what's called eschatology, which is simply the fancy word for the doctrine of the end times. Okay, that's what eschatology means. And so there's this eschatological idea that we're all heading toward this huge Armageddon in our future, not in the seven churches that he's writing to, not in their future, but in our future, as if this whole thing was written for us today, and that the seven churches of Asia were just kind of like, you know, the original recipients of the letter or the revelation here, but not really having to do anything with them in particular. Which begs the question, does Jesus ever do something like that? Does he operate like that? Does God ever operate like that? And of course, the questions are resoundingly, no, he does not. All right, so they gathered together in this place called Armageddon, and I do give you in my notes that this comes from a combined Hebrew word, which means Har-Mageddon, or the mountain of Megiddo, and Megiddo means slaughter in Hebrew. Well, it's a mountain of slaughter, the valley of slaughter, the place of slaughter, and was known as the place where the kings come to battle in the Old Testament. Most famously, where King Josiah, went out to meet Pharaoh Necho, as Pharaoh was going up to Carchemish to battle the Babylonians there, and was soundingly defeated, by the way. But on his way up, Josiah interrupts that on the valley or the plains of Megiddo there and tries to stop Pharaoh because he thinks Pharaoh's just trying to invade Palestine. And Pharaoh is not, but Josiah gets killed in the process. And then the turn for Judah just just suddenly goes downward after the death of Josiah. So it's a kind of a harbinger of bad things to come there. So we see that this war, as I point out in the notes here, is not actually described until chapter 19 in Revelation. It's kind of foretold here, but it's not actually described. And in chapter 19, you see this long, protracted battle, right, where Jesus' forces advance, and then they're pushed back, and then, you know, they advance a little bit more, and then there's a lot of bloodshed, and angels fall, and Jesus gets a couple of, you know, wounds on him, but then he comes back fighting with a great sword. You see all that, right? No. I just made all that up. See how fascinating it gets when you make stuff up? And there is a kernel of truth to that. If you go to the so-called Christian bookstores and you look in the eschatology section or the end time section or whatever they want to call it, and there's a whole lot of books that do all kinds of fancy footwork like that. And why is that? Because people eat it up. Nobody wants to hear the truth of the matter, which is boring by comparison. Oh, okay, so God wins and Satan doesn't even have a chance. That's the truth of it. Nobody wants to hear that, but that's exactly what we want to hear as God's people. We want to hear that God wins, that God always wins, and Satan always gets defeated. And Satan will always fail. He's always failed. Every single time he's failed at anything he does, and this is just another account of his failure. That's what we want to hear. The world wants to hear science fiction and, you know, big tanks and Apache helicopters and explosions and, you know, bloodshed and, you know, all kinds of wars and everything else, because that's, you know, all glorified and hyped up stuff that we that again, our social conscience likes to hear and wants to lap up. Kind of like a giant video game, you know, that's all played out in real life. That's what we want to hear as people, but that's not what the truth is all about there. Okay? Did you have something to say, Roy?
I was
going to
say, we've been told Satan lost at the cross.
Yep.
It's a done deal. All of this stuff is just telling us what's going to happen to who.
Right.
Well, that's what comes out later. It just makes a whole lot more sense when you realize, why did we talk about the seven churches of Asia? Because there's going to be a lot of turmoil that comes out as the church gets going.
Right. Another aside, this one from Jesus himself in the midst of this revelation. Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake and keeps his clothes. In other words, to not be found naked. Nakedness in this context suggests being unprepared, unfit for whatever circumstance, or even vulnerable. Okay, so to keep your clothes means to be prepared, to be fit, to be ready for what's happening. So that he will not walk around naked and men will not see his shame. And then John continues in the vision, they gathered them together in the place which is in Hebrew called Harmageddon, or famously Armageddon. Okay? And then we have the seventh bowl of wrath. The first six have been pretty nasty. The seventh one is poured out upon the air. And a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne saying, "It is done." And what comes from the air? In verse 18, flashes of lightning, sounds and peals of thunder, and there was a great earthquake such as not been since the earth came to be. And the great city was split into three parts. The cities of the nations fell. Babylon the Great. Remember what Babylon is? Babylon is essentially Rome. Okay, not just the city of Rome, but really the Roman Empire that is characterized by the city of Rome. And Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath. We've talked about the wrath of God several times, that God's wrath is very real and, of course, is going to be unleashed against those who suppress unrighteousness, as Paul says in Romans 1:18 and 19. So we see that this is poured out upon the air. Is there anywhere in Scripture something significant about who controls the air or whose power is in the air? Does that sound familiar to you? Like the prince of the power of the air? That sound familiar? Huh? Well, I know you are correct. He owns all those things, but there's a specific reference here. Paul says in Ephesians 2, he's speaking to Christians, right? He says that you were dead, in other words, in the past, before your conversion, in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air. And then defines it further as the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Doesn't this sound familiar? Doesn't this sound like what we're talking about? Then we have the prince of the power of the air. And interestingly, how do you control air? Right? I mean, if your dominion is air, then what exactly do you have? It's kind of an ironic way of saying that even though he has a kingdom and he's a prince, meaning Satan here, but he doesn't really control anything, you know, except for the air, which is to say nothing substantial. But we see that this seventh bowl is poured out upon the air, and then disaster immediately starts falling from the air in the form of the lightning, and then we get the hailstones and so on. Okay, so there's all this stuff that is going on that kind of goes over our head if we don't stop and pay attention to some of the references, the allusions that are being made here, and so we see that this is all happening against the Roman Empire, but specifically against the heart of the beast. And we're really watching the death throes of the beast here. We're not just seeing a head wound like we saw back in chapter 13. Remember, one of the heads was wounded, and mortally wounded, and then it came back to life. Now we're seeing all of the heads, in essence, being wounded, and mortally so that they're not going to come back to life. Okay? I need to get back to Revelation 16. And so we see the city being split apart. Again, the city meaning Rome, but not just Rome, not limited to Rome. The cities of the nations fell. Every island fled away. The mountains were not found. In other words, everything's being destroyed in the process. Not literally so, of course, right? Because this is a vision. And this is a vision about a moral judgment upon a people. It's not a physical judgment per se. It's, in other words, we don't see literal hailstones coming down like you see in the next verse. We're not seeing that happening historically. But we are seeing devastation. We're seeing moral, spiritual devastation. These people are in darkness. They are being tormented. They are lost and without hope. They are so entrenched in their sins that they don't even want to get out of them. They don't care what kind of pain they got to go through as long as they can still do what they want to do. And then we see all this kind of this suffering that keeps coming upon the entire empire and upon the beast itself. Huge hailstones, about 100 pounds each, came down from heaven. And what do men do? They blaspheme God because of the plague of the hail, because his plague was extremely severe. Well, that would be severe if we imagine we were getting suddenly pummeled by 100-pound hailstones. I think that would cause some damage, don't you? Right? I mean, that is a terrific amount of damage. Now, again, this is not literal, but just think about it as if it were, just for a moment, to get an idea of what God is trying to convey here. This is a disaster that they're not going to get out of. They're not going to walk away from. Okay? If you go to Wyoming or Montana, you'll every once in a while see on the in town, you'll see these cars driving around with all these little pocket marks on them, all over the hood and the top. And that's because there are outlying areas around Billings that have hailstorms. And the hailstones do get about golf ball size, and they come down and they destroy cars just from hitting them with such force. Now, these are little golf ball-sized hailstones, okay? But even those leave a lot of damage. So I'm just saying that to give you an idea, again, to compare the destruction of that. This is little superficial destruction compared to what God is talking about. Spiritual and moral destruction is always far more disastrous than any physical destruction. We can always rebuild cities. We can always rebuild cars and houses. You can't rebuild people. And you can't rebuild societies. You can't rebuild societies that have sunk so low that the only thing left for them is to be destroyed. That's kind of what we're looking at here. A society that just, it there's no redemption left in it. The only thing left for it is to be destroyed. Now, it doesn't mean that every person in that society is potently evil. But it does mean that the society itself and what it was built upon and why it was built and so on, that has to go. That system has to go. Any questions or comments? All right, now the fun part. You say, I thought that was the fun part. No, now the fun part. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with John. That's the me here. Saying, come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. We haven't been introduced specifically to this harlot yet. What is a harlot? Once again, just for clarification. A prostitute? What's another way we could describe a harlot? Yes, one that sells themselves. I'm thinking more generically. How about a woman of ill repute? Okay? A woman who is just a fornicating woman. Let's just be blunt. Right? A woman who is just, you know, sexually immoral in every way. Okay? So we get an idea. And I'm saying that graphically on purpose. So we get an idea of who this woman is. She's not an actual woman. You know that, right? Because this is a vision. This is not an actual woman at all. But it does talk about her as a woman, or talk about this what she represents as this great harlot. And the many waters, what are the many waters?
The sea of humanity.
Yeah. In fact, he tells you later on, verse 15, the waters which you saw, because John is getting an explanation here. The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. Okay? So now we know. Now we know what the waters are. It's not oceans or seas or anything like that. It's actually people. So this woman is sitting on all these people. And that doesn't mean that she's literally sitting on a bunch of people propping her up, but that she, in a sense, reigns over them. She has control of them. Okay? She is the head of them. In being above them, she controls them and directs them. So that tells you something about the nature of the peoples, the multitudes themselves, that they are being directed by the mind of a harlot. Well, that's always going to end up well, right? A nation controlled by a harlot is doomed, right? I mean, you're just not going to get anything good out of that because, again, the leadership is already corrupted. So, and it says specifically, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. What is immorality, just so we all know? What's that? No morals. Technically true. Okay? It's the opposite of morality. Immorality. Like immortality is the opposite of mortality, right? So immorality, technically, yes, is the opposite of morality. But what does that mean? Can we get a different definition? Phil?
Mine reads sexual immorality.
Yeah. Completely. Immorality is often sexual in nature, obviously, because that's where a lot of the non-morality or the against morality is manifested, is sexually. If you read Paul's writing there in Romans chapter 1 that we cited earlier, from about verse 21 down through verse 27, he talks about this. He says that people turned away from God and they showed no gratitude toward the Creator. They worshiped the creature rather than the Creator himself. And in doing so, what did they descend into? Two main things, idolatry and immorality. In other words, they worship creatures as though they were the Creator, and then in doing so they degrade themselves morally, or they degrade themselves by becoming sexually immoral. And goes on to say, and no one wants to hear this today in our society, but goes on to say that in graphic detail, that men burning in desire with other men and women doing the same with other women, which is the description of homosexuality, or other perverse crimes, sexual crimes. So this is where it takes us. Once you turn away from God, all these things start happening. happening, and it descends to always to a certain direction there, or in a certain direction. And I say no one wants to hear this today because, you know, we don't want to offend the homosexuals, and we don't want to offend sinners. We'd rather offend God rather than sinners. So we're going to offend God by ignoring what he says about such behavior and instead try to, you know, court the favor of those people committing these crimes. So it's just all perverse. It's all broken up and upside down and backward from what it should be. Okay, so that gives us an idea of what we're dealing with here in this particular context. Nita? Right.
Live by. So in being immoral is letting go of that, having those self-control,
right.
Having those rules that you're living by.
Well, it's a lack of moral restraint and the lack of you know, any kind of discipline, self-discipline. You're right. And the rules, of course, would be, in essence, God's rules, God's commandments. You know, whatever God tells us is true. So that's the nature of this woman. And look at the effect that she's having on the people. They're drunk with the wine of her immorality. Obviously not literal, but still, graphically and powerfully indicating here the influence that she is having, that this immorality is having on the people. And we know this historically. Rome descended greatly into all kinds of immorality, sexual immorality in particular. In fact, I don't know if some of you have studied the city of Pompeii that was destroyed by Mount Vesuvius there in, what was it, 73? They found on the walls there, you know, graphic details of people having sexual relations in all kinds of bizarre and very hedonistic ways. In other words, this was a, and they found a lot of this, by the way, and this was a city that was just overwhelmed with immorality. And if that's just one city in Italy, okay, you can imagine that there probably was others that were like that. And by the way, that took place 20 years before we believe that this was actually written. So that it didn't get better, it just got worse. And so I'm not saying that just because Pompeii was like that, then the whole empire was like that. What I'm saying, though, is that we have evidence, historical, archaeological, physical evidence, that the city was immersed in this immorality. Right? And the empire was immersed in this immorality. Verse 3, it says, "He carried me away in the spirit to a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast," and this is the woman here that we're talking about, "full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns." It's the beast that has the seven heads and ten horns, by the way. "The woman herself, she's clothed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls." In other words, having outwardly the appearance of great beauty and opulence and wealth. And, you know, like this is, she's a successful woman because she has all these gems and jewels. "Having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations," or you could just simply say moral filth, okay, "and of unclean things, of her immorality. On her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth." So this woman prides herself. Again, she's not a real woman, but we'll just call her that for the sake of the picture here. This woman prides herself on being the queen of the harlots. She is the queen. She is the greatest harlot of all, the greatest prostitute, the greatest, you know, sexually immoral person on the earth, and she's proud of that. There's no shame here. Jim?
I think that's really interesting that it's kind of seductive in that you look at, instead of talking about beauty and physical attraction there, right? And it's the same thing in people today. We look at, you know, big time successful people that looks really attractive, and then you find out that they've got a really seedy background and underbelly there, you know what I'm saying?
Right. Seedy underbelly. I like that. Right. In fact, I actually used that phrase myself before, but to hear you say it, it just sounds, you know, different. Okay. So, yeah. So as you see here, what we're talking about, page, I think it's 16, but it's the pages got messed up here. I'm sorry about that. I don't know what happened. But the next page, it symbolizes the pleasure-mad, sensuous, and irrational Roman society, drunk with its pursuit of excess in any form. And so this harlot, as you see in the notes, is the counterfeit of the bride of Christ. Remember, every time we see God putting up a figure, a symbol, a person, and Satan comes along with a false figure, a false symbol, a false person, something that seems to equal that or be on the same level of that, but is completely falls short of whatever God is doing. And by falling short means it's doomed to fail from the beginning. This woman is doomed to fail. I mean, we know she does fail. We know she, I think, before the end of the chapter, she dies. Okay, so right now, the picture is she's full of good health and adorned with jewelry and, you know, all this great opulence that she's displaying here. But the fact is, she's going to be destroyed by the very people that she intoxicated with all of her immorality. She'll be destroyed. Because evil is like that. Evil is always self-consuming. Evil always destroys evil. Okay? And so if you had an evil nation with evil leadership, the best thing the people could do is just step back and let the leaders devour each other, because they will over time. And unfortunately, we all suffer in the process. But that's what's going to happen over time, is that evil always consumes evil. Because it can't sustain itself. It always has to devour something in order for itself to stay alive. And so pretty soon it turns on the only power that's left, which is itself. And so it's just kind of one of those strange ironies of human history. Nina? May or may not be able to answer. Yes. Well, your cups just represent a container of whatever is the content. So I wouldn't read too much into that myself. I wouldn't recommend reading too much. God's cup of wrath is just simply giving his wrath in a certain condensed symbolic form here. And the cup of her immorality is just, this is what she's drinking. Okay, a vessel, right? I don't know if they want to read too much into that, but it does say in verse 6, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly. And of course, you would wonder, who is this woman? Where did she come from? Why is she here? Why does she have so much power? Why is she drinking the blood of the saints? What does that indicate? Is this immoral, this hugely promiscuous, sexually immoral woman drinking the blood of the saints? What would that indicate there, Will? Okay. I wouldn't go with that. Although I see why you got there, but we'll re-examine that. Mike, what'd you have to say? Okay, so it would be more of the blood of martyrs. In other words, not people giving in, but people being given over, okay, in the sense of being martyred and being killed. And then that blood, drinking their blood, is kind of like celebrating the death of these people, celebrating their death, celebrating these martyrs as if they are so meaningless that I can eat them or devour them or drink their blood and they mean nothing to me. By the way, what does God say about drinking blood in the Bible? It's an abomination to him. And yet this woman drinks the blood of God's own saints and has no shame, no qualms with that, no, you know, problem with doing that. Not only is she drinking blood, but she's drinking the blood of God's people, his murdered martyrs, his saints. Do you think that God's just going to stand by and let this happen? Absolutely not. which is why this woman has very short time to live. Okay, that's what that indicates there. This is where it gets sticky. Oh, wow, I have 3 minutes to explain some of the hardest verses in Revelation. He does say in verse 7, why do you wonder? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, the beast which has the 7 heads and 10 horns, which we were introduced to, remember, back in Revelation 13, the opening of chapter 13. So, the beast you saw was and is not and is about to come out of the abyss and go to destruction. That is one of the most difficult phrases or sayings or sentences in the entire book. What it means in essence, it's not hard to understand what it means in its most basic sense, is that this beast had power, may not have its full power now, but is going to have full power. It was, is not, but is going to come. But then right after it gains power, it's almost like as soon as it crests or reaches that apex of power, it is destroyed at the height of its power. Now remember, we talked about the beast and what the beast represents. It's the emperors or the imperial power of Rome. So whatever this is saying here, it's talking about those emperors themselves, which he goes on to talk about here. Here's the mind which has wisdom, verse 9, the 7 heads or 7 mountains on which the woman sits. Well, we know Rome was built on 7 hills. And so the idea here is that this is speaking of where not just Rome the city, but where the emperors rule from. The emperors rule from Rome. That's where their headquarters is. The capital city of the empire is Rome. And he says they are 7 kings, 5 have fallen, 1 is, the other has not yet come. But when he comes, he must remain a little while. The beast which was and is not is himself also an 8th and is 1 of the 7. If you remember from our numerology class, we talked about number 7 and then the number 8. What does the number 8 signify? A renewed power or a new power, a new dynasty, a new, sometimes a new kingdom or you know, just a new life. So what it's talking about is something of this beast, the imperial Rome. Something has already run its course. And now is in a bit of a lag, but is going to have a renewed power, a resurgence, a kind of a rebirth from that that is based upon that former power. Okay, that's really what he's saying here. So there was a former power of the Roman emperors that has gone through a time of difficulty, but is going to come out, and one of those emperors is going to be an 8th. Doesn't mean an 8th literally, but an 8th symbolically, as we've been studying in our numerology class. In other words, seemingly a new power, but based upon the old power. Does that make sense? How many people did I lose already? Okay, and if you think about, we have talked about this, and we'll talk about this in our numerology class, so the number 666, that if we have this right. And this is talking about Nero being reborn in the work and activity of a different emperor that is not Nero, but is like Nero and then some. A new power, as if Nero was reborn. A new power in the likeness of the old power. Now I'm going to have to stop right there, and I will further explain that next week. I was going to go to another chart here and show you what I'm talking about, but we ran out of time. Why did we run out of time? Because the clock doesn't stop, okay? It just keeps going no matter what. So we will talk about that next week and get into more detail with that.